from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the state polls a controversial question from the MCAS exam. Also, a split among state Republicans over Democratic efforts to expand access to abortion.
The party can have a position. I just think that this is a decision that a woman should make with her family and with her doctor, and it shouldn't be legislated upon.
And Tufts University hires an investigator to review its ties to Big Pharma.
Tufts does investigations when it doesn't want to take action.
Plus, the surprising story of how a nurse from Brighton became a mom.
She was in a stroller with one of the nurses walking, and I said, "Who is that beautiful little angel?" And she said her name's Giselle, and I had heard about her. And at that moment, I knew that was it, and I never looked back.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is pulling a controversial question from the MCAS exam. The move comes after criticism of a question on a 10th grade English language arts exam that some students, some parents, and some advocacy groups have strongly criticized. The department has not released the text of the question, but joining me to discuss this further is Jack Schneider. He's an assistant professor of education at UMass Lowell and the director of research for the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So let's explain first why this question is controversial, even though we don't know exactly what the question is. So it's a little tricky because no one is supposed to say what the questions are. But the Department of Education also has not released the text of it, but we know it pulled the question because of this controversy. And we do know that the exam contained a prompt asking students to write from the point of view of a racist character from the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Underground Railroad. Is that your understanding?
That's what we've been told. And, I think there's been some pushback on whether or not the character is in fact racist. And I think one of the things that's worth discussing is, does that even matter if certain students felt that they were being asked to inhabit a character whose views make them feel like they don't belong here in the United States or in their schools.
Right. But the department has said after excluding this item, they feel that the test overall is sound. Is that sufficient?
I think this is an unfortunate episode that was clearly an oversight. It's not really a story about bad intentions. I think the more interesting story here is the fact that this really reveals the limits of what a state-developed standardized test is able to do, because it certainly shows that it can't be context-specific and that it isn't really tailored to the sort of unique needs, interests, concerns of particular communities, and it's not really a particularly useful device for teaching anybody anything.
Well, let's talk about how questions like this might be vetted. Is it a problem with the vetting process? Because it's my understanding, based on what we're reading here from the department and others, that the questions go through a process of folks determining whether they might be too sensitive to be used on a test like this, and this went through the process. So what happened?
Yeah, it went through the process. Not only did it go through a bias and sensitivity committee, but it also was pilot tested last year. So, I think that the real story here is that if your concerns are with the psychometric properties of a question, right, so the science of measurement, then your concerns are not going to be about the motivation, feelings, empowerment, or even the education of students, right? That when you are developing a test question, you just have different priorities and concerns. And I think that people often believe that test developers are somehow involved in the educational process. They're not. They're involved in the science of measurement. And it is quite possible to develop an offensive question that has great psychometric properties. It's reliable and valid in terms of the statistical methods.
So that's why, say, for example, you're not saying that if you were asking a student to try to put themselves in, say, the shoes of colonialists or Spanish settlers or any oppressor, so they may understand how how that sort of position of oppression came to be. You're not saying that that should never happen with students.
I think that great teachers ask students to inhabit characters all the time and have real pedagogical purposes there. I think test developers don't have pedagogical purposes. All they care about is measuring whether or not a student can respond to a prompt. To them, the content of the prompt basically is irrelevant. And I think that actually is the core underlying issue here.
So you think that this raises questions about the whole function of MCAS itself? What do we need this test for?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'll leave it up to the people of Massachusetts to decide what we need this test for and whether we need it or not. But, you know, I think one important thing to distinguish is that MCAS is a surveillance system. And I don't mean that in a sort of creepy way, right? It's designed to acquire information for the state so that the state can, quote unquote, see what's going on in the 1800 schools where they can't actually have people. It is not designed as an educational system. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people need to be clear on that, and many people are, that the purpose of MCAS is to acquire information. It's a surveillance system. It is not a pedagogical system.
Right. But how do you make sure that students are progressing? Obviously, this is always the question, right? How do you make sure that students are making progress and are retaining information and are, you know, doing what they're supposed to be doing in terms of, it's a difficult thing to gauge, right? Is there a better way?
I obviously think there's a better way. I'm the author of a book, the subtitle of which is A Better Way to Measure School Quality. We've got our project, the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment, where we believe actually that you don't need standardized tests. You can use classroom-embedded, teacher-developed performance assessments that are really embedded in the context of a school and developed by people who understand their students and who really have a pedagogical purpose when they are measuring student learning. That there is, in fact, a better way. But I think even setting that aside, the deeper issue with state testing isn't even the 5 to 7 hours that students spend taking the MCAS. It's all of the practice hours they spend on these test questions. And when we look at questions like this, you know, even setting aside the potentially racist character of the questions, we have to ask, is this the best way for our students to be spending their time? Again, these questions are not developed for an educational purpose. They're developed for a measurement purpose.
So this debate has been going on for as long as we've had standardized tests of various forms, right, about the best way to try to gauge what students might be gaining educationally. But I'm wondering if this doesn't do something along those lines, could it, in your mind, do something about maybe improving the vetting process and four questions? And what would that look like?
You know, the state, to its credit, has a, you know, fairly robust vetting process. I think, you know, one of the things that this speaks to, though, is the sheer volume of questions that they need to vet every single year. And that even when a vetting committee is seemingly diverse and representative, that they're clearly missing some things. You know, I'm thinking, for instance, about students and what students see that people on vetting committees might not. It raises questions about who should have a say here, and the state probably is going to consider including an even more diverse and representative group of folks to be taking a look at their items.
All right. Jack Schneider, Assistant Professor of Education at UMass Lowell and Director of Research for the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Members of the Massachusetts Republican Party are blasting a bill that would expand access to abortion. Among other things, the legislation would allow women to get an abortion after 24 weeks of pregnancy in cases where the fetus is not expected to survive. The current standard only allows for an abortion after 24 weeks if the mother's life is in jeopardy. The legislation also removes the requirement that women under the age of 18 get a parent's consent before having an abortion. In a letter, State Republican Party Chair Jim Lyons describes the bill as radical infanticide. To talk more about this, we reached out to Jennifer Nassour, former head of the Massachusetts Republican Party and CEO of the nonpartisan coalition supporting female candidates that's called Reflect Us. We started by asking her about the strong words from Jim Lyons.
I recognize the chairman's frustration, and I know him, and he is definitely the type of person who just likes to go ahead with his feelings. And I think that that's fabulous. However, this is a really sensitive subject. And I think that one of the problems that the Republican Party has currently is that the messengers are not messaging communications as well as they can message it. And so it's one thing for him as the head of the Mass GOP to take a stand. I think that his delivery, though, could have used a little bit of a softer touch.
But even the governor said he doesn't support expanding abortion access after 24 weeks, which this legislation would do. I mean, is that a shift, really, in a conservative position, even if we message it a little bit more softly? You
know? Well, I think that the position of the party had always been, not while I was chair, but for other chairs, and not necessarily the platform of the party had always been anti-abortion. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it didn't speak to it. Other times it did. I think that there's a difference between being pro-choice and being pro-abortion at, you know, late-term abortion. But what I think is that our party leaders also have to, there's a couple of things in this bill, right? So, and I think we're talking about a couple of different things. So if we're talking about late-term abortion, our party leaders also need to speak to women who are maybe older or women who have encountered things that they have no control over. And if it's the difference between the health of a mother and a mother being alive to watch her other children and raise her other children, or the mother's health, I think that that comes into consideration. I don't think anyone ever wants to have an abortion, ever, let alone a late-term abortion. And so I think that it's a different way of messaging that and understanding. And the party can have a position. I just think that we need to be conscious of the fact that there are women out there that are put in very bad positions and they don't know what to do, and this is the last recourse. I think the difference with this bill, though, is that it calls for public funding. It has a component where minors don't have to seek permission, or parents don't have to give consent. Guardians don't have to give consent. I have teenagers and young kids that would fall into this, and I would be horrified if anything happened and I wasn't consented. And so my daughter needs my consent to go get ear piercings under 18. Well, I think that she would need consent if she was getting an abortion.
Sounds to me as if you think that allowing abortions after 24 weeks should be a decision that a woman should be allowed to make and that lawmakers should stay out of.
I do. I think lawmakers should stay out of it. I don't think that anyone should come into your bedroom or come into your family decisions. And this is a decision that a woman should make with her family and with her doctor, and it shouldn't be legislated upon.
Is this a move on the part of the Massachusetts Republican Party toward becoming more conservative? The party here has always been liberal on social issues for a very long time. So when you hear the new head of the state Republican Party saying these kinds of things, people wonder, what does that mean for the Republican Party in this state? What do you think?
Well, it's definitely not the party that I was in charge of. where Charlie Baker and Richard Tesei were running for governor and lieutenant governor. You know, Charlie Baker is still the head of the party, despite the fact that Jim Lyons was elected. And Jim Lyons was elected by a substantial majority of the state committee. But that state committee is represented by 80 men and women. And that's a small population of people who consider themselves Republicans. And I think that the typical Republican still in Massachusetts is a person who is fiscally conservative and socially more libertarian.
And Governor Baker, though, has said that he would not support expanded access to abortion after 24 weeks. So that's a little bit different, too. So I think people are wondering, you know, what's happening here? Is something happening?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, the governor is again, he is governing an entire state. And I think that this bill has tax implications in it as well. And so it's more than, you know, it's not as cut and dry as just the 24 weeks. It's also where there would be use of taxpayer dollars. And I think when we start talking about use of taxpayer dollars, that changes the conversation substantially. And I think also our legislators have, you know, both on the state and national level have gotten to a point where they like writing comprehensive bills instead of bills that just cover one subject over another. And so I think if we're talking taxpayer dollars, the bill is going to be dead on arrival.
Well, at the same time, the governor has proposed increased funding for Title X to protect, you know, certain reproductive health centers. So how do those things square in your mind?
Well, because I think reproductive health centers do a barrage of different things, right? They're providing health care to women who cannot afford health care as we know it. They don't have the same access to quality doctors that other women around the state do. And I think that those health centers, that's a different – the abortion performing aspect, again, is not something that you want to know that goes on a daily basis. You're hoping that women are seeking preventative measures and that that is the last case scenario that they're getting into. And so I think for the health centers, that what they're providing is a service for women for access to birth control, for making sure that they have preventative care and that they're getting the quality care that is needed. And also as they go along, if they are pregnant, in caring for them in total.
When you hear strong language like this from the head of the state Republican Party, I mean, does it suggest that there is an emboldening? And does that come from the national level and what we're hearing from national Republicans?
No, I think that, you know, Chairman Lyons, he had felt the same way back in 2010 when he was running for state rep as he does currently as the party chair. And the only difference is that the state committee selected him to run the party. I don't think that he feels emboldened at all. I just think that Jim, this is just the way that he reacts. And I give him credit because, you know, a lot of our political leaders are not willing to go out and just blurt things out and say what they feel. And whether we agree with it or not, there's something that is refreshing to know that there's someone out there who does do that and hasn't changed during his course and his tenure in the state house and is still doing the same stuff.
And you don't think it'll harm the Republican Party?
No, I don't think so, because really, you know, the Republican in Massachusetts, they run on their own platforms. They run based on their own history, based on their own beliefs, based on their own sets of values and morals. And we're all different across the state. And that's what actually I loved about being chair of the Republican Party, because I would have some members that were definitely would look like a Democrat in any other state other than Massachusetts. And then I would go all the way over to Jim Lyons, who was, you know, one of the more conservative members of the party. And so I think that that's a great thing. And you want to have a big tent and a variety of opinions.
Do you think that because of what's happening nationally, there's a lot of debate about what might happen with the abortion issue? New Supreme Court, different states are passing different laws. Do you think that this issue is going to come forward again in Massachusetts and we're going to be debating it?
No, because the governor won't let that happen. I mean, this is a totally different issue than access to reproductive health care and rights. And as we've seen, the governor has given more money to Title X. That is a priority for him. I don't think it will go away. I don't think it's going to change nationally, nor in Massachusetts. And look, at the end of the day, Roe v. Wade is, you know, passed 45, 46 years ago. It's a long time that that's been in effect.
Jennifer Nassar, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party and CEO of Reflect Us, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4923. 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Some local universities are examining their ties to Big Pharma, specifically Purdue Pharma and its owners, the Sackler family. The Sacklers are listed as the 19th richest family in America, and they've been major donors to universities and cultural institutions throughout the country. But the role of the Sackler fortune is raising questions and protests from those who say that their money comes from the OxyContin opioid painkiller. Tufts University has hired an investigator to review the school's ties to the Sacklers, and that's largely because of a lawsuit from State Attorney General Maura Healey that alleges that the Sackler family tried to influence Tufts and its hospital. Here to break some of this down for us from Washington, D.C. is Nell Gluckman. She's a higher education reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Ed. Hi there.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
We're okay. Well, we've been covering this lawsuit from Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, and it's complicated, hundreds of pages long, but essentially says that the Sackler family used its, quote, intense relationship with Tufts to promote Purdue Pharma products. And it says even that happened even though the company knew that its painkiller OxyContin is addictive. Help explain sort of what your understanding is in terms of these allegations of the university's role with the Sacklers.
Sure. So according to the Attorney General's lawsuit, Tufts set up this pain research program with help from the Sacklers. And the program, you know, taught future doctors and pharmacists on how to manage pain. And there was a lot of input from the Sacklers, according to the Attorney General's complaint. And so that helped the company and the family burnish their reputation in the research community and the medical community in Boston, and also connect with doctors in the area who could potentially be prescribing these medications. Mm-hmm. They've also donated to other parts of the university as well, including the medical school, and a member of the family was on the medical school's board.
Right. And some of the allegations, you know, are very strong, and they're saying that that there was a lot happening at the university, that Purdue asked Tufts to rebut negative news coverage, and that there was certainly an expectation for the amount of money that the university was given. And we should say that the university issued a statement saying that it is refraining from public comment at this time because mm-hmm. there's an independent review process going on, and it's hired former Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Don Stern. How significant is that move to have an independent review like this?
As far as I know, they're the only university with connections to the Sacklers and Purdue that has hired an outside investigator to look at it. Several other universities have said that they're looking into their connections with the family and the company and evaluating for themselves. But for Tufts, it seems like a much closer connection, and they seem to have responded with a more serious, a serious type of investigation that would really have an outside person examining what's going on there and what's been happening there.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's been a lot of debate in other universities involved, particularly local. Mm-hmm. We know about Clark and Harvard. Are those the universities you would mention as well?
Yes. At Harvard, there's the Arthur M. Sackler Museum, and there's been pressure there for the university to do something about that connection, suggestions that they change the name, but Harvard has said that they're not going to do that, that the original building came from funds from Arthur Sackler, who died before OxyContin came to market. Clark University similarly has said that its money came from Arthur Sackler, and they're not going to change the name of their science center. But Maura Healey's lawsuit also mentioned Boston University and Northeastern University, saying that they receive, albeit much smaller, gifts from the Sacklers and Purdue. At Boston University was a $50,000 gift for a program on pain, and at Northeastern it was a $15,000 gift for a program on pain management. So there are a couple others, yeah.
Well, has any university given back money, renamed building, or removed the Sackler name from anything?
Not that I know of. Some universities have said that they're no longer going to accept funds from the Sacklers or from Purdue. NYU and Columbia University have said that they're not accepting donations at this time.
If we go back to the Tufts independent review by former Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Don Stern, what do we know about an investigation like that? Do we know, will a lot of the questioning be based on the Attorney General's lawsuit? Say, for example, the allegations that there were presentations that were done at Tufts that were supposed to be friendly to Purdue products. Now, we should say the Sacklers defended those presentations and said, yes, we certainly helped those presentations go forward, but we did not control any of the content. They did not compromise the content of anything that was happening at Tufts. So do you think those are the sort of things that an investigator would look at? It would be based on the Attorney General's lawsuit?
I would imagine that an investigator would look at the lawsuit and potentially start there. When universities hire outside investigators like this, the investigator can also, of course, talk to people, faculty members and people who have taken the program. So they're not just subpoenaing for documents and looking through those. They can conduct interviews and that sort of thing. So a report like this could go even deeper, potentially, than what the Attorney General has said in her filings.
Does Tufts face the most significant allegations of all the universities, would you say?
So far, I would say so from what I have seen. Yeah. They're not being charged here. But they certainly came up a lot in this complaint from January.
Mm-hmm. And what happens, do you think? How big of a player is the Sackler family and money from companies like Purdue Pharma for universities? I'm just wondering, do you think that this is going to have a big effect, especially as we hear word that the Sacklers are considering filing bankruptcy because of the number of lawsuits here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't say exactly how much money they've given Tufts or other universities like it. The Maura Healey's complaint says that they have given hundreds of thousands of dollars, which, you know, for a place like Tufts, that wouldn't be a huge percentage of their budget. But, you know, it's probably part of a constellation of big donors that are certainly important to universities like this.
Okay. Nell Gluckman, higher education reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Ed. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to turn now to what Tufts students are saying and what's happening on campus. Some Tufts students say an investigation into the role of the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma is not enough. Joining me now is Anarin Karnam Klein. He's an executive opinion editor of the Tufts Daily and is senior at Tufts. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being with us. Now, you have said that the letter from Tufts President Monaco that was written to the Tufts community last week, where he explained that there would be this independent investigation by former U.S. Attorney Don Stern, is not sufficient. Why do you think that?
There's a number of reasons I think that. Chief among them is, an investigation of this kind won't bring justice to people who've died in the opioid epidemic. And if what is said in Attorney General Healey's lawsuit is true, then I think Tufts has a moral duty to materially contribute to the recovery of people who face addiction, particularly addiction to opioids.
What would that look like?
Well, it could take a number of forms. Tony Monaco personally the president of Tufts University, personally lobbies the Massachusetts state legislature, so he could push for safe or supervised injection sites in Massachusetts, needle exchanges, greater funding for methadone clinics and mental health programs to help people get clean and stay clean. And he could give some of the money that Tufts took from the Sacklers, not that specific money, but he can give, you know, comparable amounts to organizations that are doing harm reduction. Yeah.
I'm wondering, we just heard from Nell Gluckman, and she told us that, you know, Tufts is the really the only university that's taken this step to really investigate and to see what happened here. Because obviously, as we've said, the Sacklers and Purdue deny these allegations and say that, yes, they were benefactors, but they weren't trying to have undue influence on anyone. Does that help? What do you think of the comments and that statement?
I think it's really telling that Tufts had to hire someone to tell them to do the right thing. I think that, you know, the Sacklers can deny all they want, but I think that the emails and the actions and the documents outlined in the Attorney General's lawsuit are pretty clear that Purdue and the Sacklers leaned on Tufts in ways that legitimized a medication that they knew at the time was addictive and that in the time since then has contributed to the deaths of tens of thousands of people in the United States and thousands alone in Massachusetts. So, I mean, of course they're going to say that. They won't admit just in the court of public opinion that's what they've done, and they probably see it differently. But the material impact of their actions is death and suffering for thousands of people, and somehow they have to make that right. And if Tufts has to hire an outside consultant to tell them what their role in that was, then I don't know what to say other than the administration at Tufts has always been sort of calculating and morally bankrupt in my vision. But, yeah.
I wonder why. What's your personal connection to this issue?
So I come from New Haven, Connecticut. A lot of the people I grew up with became addicted to opiates. I've lost friends to the opioid epidemic. A lot of people I know have overdosed and died, or gone to prison, or have had to go have been in and out of rehab for years. Like, I've seen what OxyContin does to people. I've seen how it destroys lives. And the family that made that drug and sold it so openly and, you know, in a sense corrupted medical science, if Attorney General Healey is correct, that they are wealthy and free and are not facing punishment, to me, is a profound injustice. While there are thousands of people in jail for abusing prescription opiates or for, heroin possession after they got addicted to OxyContin and became opiate addicts, that to me doesn't seem right. Hmm.
You know, I just want to make sure that folks know exactly what Tufts did say in response to this. And they said this review by former Massachusetts U.S. Attorney Don Stern will determine if the school adhered to its policies and adopted best practices with respect to academic and research integrity and conflicts of interest in accepting those funds, referring to funds from the company. And it says Attorney Stern will present his findings with a team of academic leaders. It goes on to say if our existing policies and controls need to be changed or strengthened, that will happen. It sounds as if the school is taking it pretty seriously.
I'm a little cynical on this, perhaps, because that's the sort of language that they use every time someone demands something of them, and almost nothing in my 4 years here has changed for the better as a result of popular pressure, and maybe this is different, right? Maybe, you know, a lot more seems to be on the line here than in some of the political fights that students have been engaged in. But, you know, changing their investment practices 20 years after the fact, or changing who they take money from and how they take money 20 years after the fact, and doing relatively little else for their role in the opioid crisis it's peanuts. It's crumbs, right? They're not making any sort of reparation for their actions. They're not, even if they admit wrongdoing, all that results from it is a shift in policy and in terms of, you know, money going forward, and not some sense of restoration to the victims of the Sacklers and by extension, the victims of Tufts University.
Would you say that you are in the majority? Do you think most people agree with you?
I'm not sure. I know a lot of Tufts students that I've talked to about this say it's the biggest scandal Tufts has ever been involved in. Everyone I've talked to at Tufts who has friends or family who are opiate addicts are really angry about this, and they really want Tufts to do something beyond just, you know, an investigation and a change to how it takes money, right? But that said, I don't know, you know, where 100% of the students are at. I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of kids here from pharmaceutical dynasties who might be sort of terrified by that sort of political implications thereof. And there are a lot of kids who just don't really pay attention to political goings on or to, you know, the lives and deaths of heroin addicts in this country. And so I think of the people who are aware of Tufts' relationship with the Sacklers, I would say my view is, broadly speaking, the majority view.
All right. Anarin Canham Klein, executive opinion editor of the Tufts Daily and a senior at Tufts, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
A recent sensation in the Democratic primary for president is the 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Mayor Pete Buttigieg is showing particular appeal with young people. WBUR's Fred Tice reports on how those in a crowd at Northeastern University yesterday reacted to him.
School officials first invited Pete Buttigieg 9 weeks ago. At the time, they thought they'd need a room for about 150 people. Since then, interest in his campaign has exploded. Nearly 1,000 people filled an auditorium to hear Mayor Pete with an overflow crowd in an indoor quad. Some were working and in their 20s and 30s, but most were Northeastern students interested in a candidate not too much older than they.
He's a millennial. He's 37. Kind of in touch with what people in this room might be more interested in than other candidates.
4 years ago, Kyle Azuna went door-to-door for Bernie Sanders. A Northeastern senior now, he says he won't be campaigning for Sanders again.
No, I think he's too divisive in the Democratic Party right now. He did a good job of turning it left, but I don't think he's the one who could win against Trump in 2020.
Azuna says he wants a younger candidate.
Honestly, someone in my generation who is aware of problems that millennials will be facing in 20, 30 years instead of just the same old 70-plus-year-old person who's kind of disconnected from an increasingly larger portion of American society.
That generational shift in power is something 34-year-old Bobby Ortega, a financial analyst, and 29-year-old Tim Smith, a Chelsea school teacher, are looking for as well. Smith voted for Sanders in the 2016 primary. But this time, Ortega and Smith find it appealing that Buttigieg is a veteran.
I think that in order to make a well-informed decision on sending people over there and knowing what it's like, you might want to have served in a war yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. Yeah, and I, you know, we have the president now who dodged going to war a couple times. It's good to have someone who has experience in the room making decisions. And I think he had told an anecdote about how, I think the first, when he went off to get deployed, he had to, like, write a letter basically to his parents in case he didn't come back. And he said, like, having that, being that kind of headspace gives you a different perspective of how it affects everything.
Another former Sanders supporter, Christina Nguyen, in her fifth year at Northeastern, says someone else has assumed the mantle of the left.
Right now, Elizabeth Warren is running, and she's my senator. So the local preference takes precedent.
Primaries are not until next year, and Josue Espinosa is still looking for a candidate. He works at Massachusetts General Hospital. He manages a transgender health program and some endocrinology clinics. Espinosa asked Buttigieg a question about the Affordable Care Act.
Something that works in California will not work in North Dakota. Maybe, right? How do we address the diversity of our nation in every aspect, geographically, regionally, whatever it is?
Yep.
And not a one-size-fits-all approach.
Yeah, so I think what we have to do is we have to be smart in mapping the things that aren't the same and the things that are. So things that aren't the same, for example, is the availability of certain specialty care in a given geography, which may be very dense in a place like Boston, and the opposite in a place like North Dakota. And we can't let that overtake what really is universal, which is the extent to which everybody needs health care and everybody needs a way to pay for it.
Buttigieg said he wants Medicare for all who want it. Espinosa said afterwards, Buttigieg avoided answering his question.
Our country is very different. It's diverse economically, geographically, and I don't think that a Medicare for all who want it is something that will work.
A Northeastern freshman asked Buttigieg whether he supports free public college. Buttigieg said he opposes it.
Americans who have a college degree earn more on average than Americans who don't. And as a progressive, I have a hard time getting my head around the idea that a majority who earn less because they didn't go to college would subsidize a minority who earn more because they did, all the way to 100%.
Buttigieg said that might not be the best political answer given the crowd, but he received a warm applause anyway. The young audience responded enthusiastically to much that Buttigieg said about the urgency of responding to climate change, about his husband, about the importance of millennials and the generation after them participating in politics.
That report from WBUR's Fred Tice.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
And finally today, we want to bring you the story of Elizabeth Smith, the director of nursing at Franciscan Children's Hospital in Brighton and a new mom. The story of her motherhood is why we're talking with her today. We caught up with Liz this afternoon while she was waiting at Logan Airport with her 2-year-old adopted daughter, Giselle.
Thank you for having us.
So tell us about when you met Giselle.
Oh my gosh, I'll never forget the moment. I was coming out of the inpatient medical unit at Franciscan Children's, and she was in a stroller with one of the nurses walking, and I said, "Who is that beautiful little angel?" And she said her name's Giselle, and I had heard about her, and actually a couple of the nurses had said, "Have you met her? Because you two would be the perfect pair." And at that moment, I knew that was it, and I never looked back.
Wow. Why did they say that you would be the perfect pair? She was what? How many months old at that point, and what was it?
I don't know, and it's interesting because I had just come into the role as director of nursing, so they didn't even know me that well. And there were 4 nurses, I'll never forget, and they just said, "You know what, Liz, she needs a medical foster. She just has a G-tube," which is so typical of a nurse to say. But
that's a feeding tube.
It's a feeding tube, yes, a gastric tube. And then they really encouraged it. And then I put it in the back of my mind until that day where she literally crossed my path, where you can't deny fate in this situation.
So what do you think it was that drew you to her?
It's hard to explain. I had just come off a door closing in my mind to motherhood when I found out, you know, my clinical picture had changed and I wasn't going to be able to have children on my own. And I wasn't really open to fostering and adopting. I don't know for what reason. And I think, you know, there was a lot of outside influence that put her in my path, and there she was. And it opened doors to being a mom, which I thought had closed at one point, which was really sad.
So you wanted to be a mom?
Always, since I was a little girl. I can't remember a moment where I didn't want to be, and I love being an auntie, and I thought that would be enough, and I thought being surrounded by kids at work as well, but it wasn't, and a lot of people around me knew that I was struggling with that, but it was hard for me to identify myself because I felt like, you know, it just wasn't meant to be.
Now, you mentioned the feeding tube, so Giselle had some health issues.
Yeah, so she was born less than 2 pounds, and being premature and with the complications of withdrawing from drugs, she was faced with a lot of challenge, you know, chronic lung disease, gastric reflux, multiple issues. When she came to Franciscan Children's, she needed more pulmonary rehab and feeding therapy. So kids that go through trauma like that and have medical diagnoses that don't make eating comfortable develop what's called an oral aversion. Mm-hmm. So she didn't relate any pleasure to eating, and that's why she required a gastric tube to be put in place.
So her mother had a substance use disorder.
She did. Giselle was born July of 2016, and it was an open case, and then the state took over full custody in that October.
Because of her mom's drug use?
Yes, because there was they were concerned about their ability to care for Giselle.
Mm-hmm. And so she had been at the hospital for quite some time, presumably going through efforts to improve her health. Did her mom ever visit her in the hospital, or what was, or other people from her biological parents' family or anybody?
Very few. So I am not sure about when they were in the neonatal ICU, but when they got to Franciscan Children's and after the state took custody, there were supervised visits only, and there were few of those. And then outside of that, not many people that I know of. And I remember the first time her lawyer contacted me, he said, I walked in the room and said, wow, she must have so many visitors. And the nurses said, no, she actually doesn't. And after the first day I met her, a day didn't pass where I didn't go see her.
Hmm. Now, so you're visiting Giselle every day, and you do agree with the folks who are advising you to foster Giselle, but... You know, this is a long process, and Giselle's biological parents still had visitation rights. So what was that like?
That was hard. So like I said, I knew I was meant to foster her, and it happened so quickly because she was at a critical point as far as her developmental milestones. So I just did it, and I did what she needed, and, you know, kind of had that in the background the whole time, knowing the goal was reunification. But at the same time, it's impossible to love a child 80% or partially. So I gave it my all and had days where I was nauseous thinking about the possibility of losing her, but I knew it was a reality too.
Why was it critical in terms of developmental milestones that she not be in a hospital? What would fostering do to improve her performance in those milestones and achieving those milestones?
Franciscan Children's has incredible staff, and they did the best they could to nurture and provide her with that caring ability. But she was 8 months and had never left the hospital, and there's limited amount of development you can do in a crib. And once she came home, she was barely sitting up when I took her home April 13th, and by October she was walking and babbling and singing and actually didn't even qualify for early intervention anymore. So it was pretty remarkable.
Wow. Wow. So you take her home, you foster her. There's still supervised visitations with her biological parents. Was that uncomfortable?
I did not go, so I would drop her off, and DCF social workers would observe the visits, and it was very anxiety-provoking. I knew she was safe. It was weekly for a while, and eventually, as the parents disengaged a bit, it went bi-weekly, but there were visits up until May of 2018.
Mm-hmm. And then her parents' rights were terminated.
Yeah. So eventually I feel like they disengaged more and more and knew, had met me and had knew that I was caring for her, and they would make comments of how good she looked. And I think at some point, if at all possible, they came to terms that they could not care for her and then just completely disengaged.
And what was that like when that happened? I mean, it's such a bittersweet thing, right?
So the day that her parents' rights were terminated, I expected to be relieved. And I got the call and I actually hung up from the social worker and started crying in my car, because it was that bittersweet that this amazing miracle had come into my life and was a huge gain for me and my family, but at the same time, a loss for another family. And that was really, it's really hard to think about it and celebrate knowing somebody else is suffering.
Right, right. And so then you finally did get to adopt her in October.
Yes. And that was the day that was full of excitement.
Yeah. So that must have been, I mean, were you relieved? Did it make you feel like, okay, I'm safe now. She's mine. And what did it do? Does it make things different?
You know, as soon as that judge said Giselle Catherine Smith, I felt this immediate sense of relief and stability and just calmness. It's a feeling that it's hard to describe, but after that moment, I felt just so relieved. I didn't realize how much it was still impacting me until it was official. I always had that stress that something could interfere with this, what I felt to be the best thing that's ever happened in my life.
So what's the message to other parents, folks who are listening? What's your message to them?
I really can't encourage more people who feel like they have to follow a plan to parenthood to think outside the box and consider fostering and adoption. There are so many kids like Giselle that need a loving home, and it can really transform not just the child's life, but theirs.
And how's she doing now?
She's doing great. I'm looking at her right now climbing out of her stroller. She is thriving. She doesn't stop singing and talking, and she's the most loving person and has this vibrant personality that captures people as soon as they meet her. She still gets her nutrition primarily through her G2, but other than that, she's incredible.
Yeah. Can we say hi to her?
Of course. Giselle, can you say hi, Deborah?
Hi, Giselle.
Can you sing? It's a microphone. Ready? Sing.
My only dungeon. You'll make me happy. And it's a pain. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Your team was in the way.
Hey! All right, Giselle.
There you go.
All right, Liz Smith, Director of Nursing at Franciscan Children's Hospital in Brighton. Liz, congratulations to you and to Giselle and to your new family, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Okay, should we say goodbye to Giselle, too?
Bye-bye.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.